Thank you very much to Celia Irwin for the poem on stress. That was by Adrian Plass, if you want to track it down. You might have wondered what Linda's little exchange in the pulpit was with me. She was telling me that I hadn't been given an intimation I should have made, and it's that those who are on committees, the organizing committees for the Boulevard, are meeting on Friday evening, the 29th of September, from 8 p.m. till 9 p.m. So if that takes you in and you're on one of those three committees, I think it is, then Friday the 29th, 8 to 9, if you can take a note of that. Father, quiet in our hearts as we come to your holy word and as we look into this difficult and complex chapter, we ask that the clear scarlet thread of your gracious purposes in the life of Jacob may be very evident to us, and that we will learn something that will teach us more about your purposes in our lives. For your glory. Amen. There's been a great deal of research conducted in the past 10 years or so on the subject of stress. For various reasons, some of which are quite obviously related to the pace and the pressures of modern life, stress has become an increasingly important factor which the medical men must take into consideration when diagnosing various illnesses. If you and I are suffering from stress, then I understand our resistance to certain physical diseases is dramatically lowered, and we become more likely to succumb. But while stress can be a bad thing in that it makes us more susceptible to illness, stress is also needed for us to do our best. Not much is achieved by people who lie sunning themselves on some tropical island's sandy beaches. The very laid-back person doesn't get very much done. We need the pressure of stress to tax our strength and to cause us to exert our energies, so that coping with stress becomes a very vital skill. And if we're going to cope with stress, we need to know just how much our particular personality is able to take and when we have to draw back because the stress factor on our lives is too great. God knows all about this. We saw 2 weeks ago when we looked at Genesis 29 that God had a gracious purpose for Jacob the cheat. God was engaged in the work of extracting from his life the dross, of refining his character, removing the impurities, and leaving only the gold. And this evening I want us to see that God used stress to continue that work, because even though this nomadic shepherd living 19 centuries before Christ had a lifestyle that you and I would categorize as being quite idyllic, he nonetheless was under enormous stress. And God knew that as well, and God had even allowed it. And I hope that you and I will see that nothing in our lives, wait for it, nothing in our lives, not even the sin in our lives, is outside of his sovereign control. Because of his great love for wretches like you and me, and if we know ourselves, we'll know that we are wretches. His immense, infinite, inexplicable love for us, he permits and even plans so much just to train us and guide us and create in us a deeper and deeper longing and desire for himself. Firstly then this evening, stress in home life. The first half of Genesis 30 is a most sordid and unhappy story. Little wonder. Here is Jacob married to two sisters, one of whom he loves very deeply, and the other of whom he hardly cares for. Just pause for a moment to notice the word hate has been dropped from the NIV in chapter 29, verse 31. The Authorized Version and the Revised Standard Version translate that, verse 31 of chapter 29, when the Lord saw that Leah was hated, he opened her womb, and she bore 4 sons. But I understand that the word hate there is a very misleading translation of the Hebrew. We're not to understand that Jacob actually hated Leah, rather that he slighted her. Compared to Rachel, she was unloved. Put it like this. Any wife very quickly knows when she is unloved. Men are actually monogamous. That means they can only truly be married to and really love one woman. I know that our society tries to tell us otherwise, but a wife knows perfectly well when her husband's affections have gone elsewhere, as Leah knew, and that's what the passage is saying. Now, no woman worth her salt is going to tolerate her rightful husband not loving her. And God wasn't going to tolerate that either. And so the Lord gave Leah son after son. And we have to try and understand that in these days, children brought honor and prestige to a woman in a way that it no longer does. Today we have the problem of overpopulation in the world, but then the problem was underpopulation and survival. And so children meant survival and security and prosperity. And God saw to it that unloved Leah had four baby boys in a row. And so the balance swung the other way, and Rachel, who was deeply loved by Jacob, now became infuriated and jealous and began ranting at Jacob and demanding children from him. And Jacob became angry back, as if, "I am God!" And the two who loved each other had a terrible row, which I guess simmered on for days, if not weeks, perhaps even months. But while you and I can stand back and understand something of the pain and the stress and unhappiness of this home, with one woman unloved and the other woman unhonored through her childlessness, and though we might be tempted to shake our heads and see that Jacob had his hands more than full trying to cope with these tempestuous sisters, the mystery, the puzzle of it all, is that God had drawn Jacob right into the midst of this situation. We can say quite definitely that it was not directly Jacob's fault. He'd been deceived, tricked, bamboozled. He'd been angry about it, furious. He hadn't wanted Leah at all. And here he was, he might think, through no fault of his own, caught between two jealous women. What had he done to deserve this? Of course, the answer is that he had deceived his own brother and his father, and God was teaching him what it was like himself to be deceived. Well, the trouble and the stress didn't get any better. It rumbled on year after year, and dare I say that God saw to it that it did. Dare I say that God was rubbing Jacob's nose in it. He was giving him the bitter taste of the fruits of deception until thoroughly he'd learned his lesson. And so we see Leah and Rachel keeping on living in the same home as bitter rivals. Rachel has the idea of using her servant girl as a surrogate mother. When we were looking at the story of Hagar many months ago now, we saw that surrogate mothers were common in the East in these days. A woman who was childless would buy herself a slave and give the slave to her husband as a concubine, and any children were regarded as belonging to the wife, to the slave's mistress. And so Bilhah became Rachel's surrogate mother and bore two sons. And then Leah decided that two could play that game, and she used her servant Zilpah as a surrogate mother. And so the rivalry continued, and the stress in the home continued. And then we come to the sordid story of the mandrakes. Mandrakes are a wild berry when they're ripe yellow in color, about the size of a nutmeg. The wee boy comes in having gathered some of the brightly colored berries. Now, they were thought of in that day to be both aphrodisiacs and also stimulants to fertility. And that was why Rachel and Leah squabbled over them. Unloved Leah was willing to part with the precious fertility drug in order to be loved. And Rachel was willing to sacrifice her husband for a night in order to get her hands on the supposed fertility drug. And so the bickering and the jealousy goes on. There is a most important and very obvious consequence of all this, which we mustn't miss. In these 7 unhappy years, 10 boys were born altogether, 6 to Leah and 2 each to the servant girls acting as surrogates. But all 10 boys grew up ungodly, even evil men. Let me hasten to add that God was going to do a marvelous work of grace in all of their lives, all 10 of them. We have to wait right to the end of the book of Genesis to see that work of grace. But until then, we find them unscrupulous and cruel and brutal. The dreadful story of chapter 34 brings a shudder to us all as they massacred an entire tribe. And then there's their dishonesty, which their younger brother Joseph reported to their father. And then there's their treatment of Joseph, selling him to slave traders and deceiving their father. And they're supposed to be the founders, the patriarchs, the pillars of the Church of God. And their despicable characters are no puzzle. Just look at the home. Just look at the family in which they were reared. We might almost say, little wonder they turned out like that. And so there's a double lesson from these unhappy verses. On the one hand, children brought up in a home without love, without security, without stability, are going to reflect that in their disregard for righteousness. While on the other hand, God is teaching Jacob the lesson of a lifetime, which will become part of his very bloodstream, that it does not pay to deceive. The bitter fruits live on and are simply not worth the short-term gain. You know, my friends, we have these chapters of the Bible in our hands, but our experience, my experience, and I'm sure yours, is that we are slow to learn the lessons. We all have an arrogance inbuilt which persuades us that we are unique. We of all people, we will be able to sin and get away with it. We are clever, we are brilliant, we are crafty. For us, it will work. These terrible rules of God's justice, these inexorable consequences of sin, may work themselves out in the lives of other people, but we'll be all right. We will be able to enjoy the fruits of our sin and escape the consequences. And so we delude ourselves, do we not? Like stubborn mules, we persist on going our own way, refusing to heed the straight, clear word of God, refusing to submit to and obey its faithful commands, refusing to be guided by its steady, shining light. Let us learn now, before it's too late, that we can no more alter the principles enshrined in Genesis 30 than we can command the tide stand still. We will have as much success in limiting the effects of our selfishness and our sin as King Canute had on the beach of the south coast of England when his throne was set down there and he commanded the waves to stop. And our society is the same. Ought we not to be praying and pleading with God for the authoritative and clear preaching of the righteousness of God from every pulpit in our land? Because this story has lessons that penetrate through to every compartment of our life and work, whether it's in our relationship with the nationalist community, or our church life, or our lives at work, or our lives at home. God's word says, be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, that will he also reap. And if we sow to the flesh and to sin, we shall reap corruption and sorrow and loss and futility. But if we sow to the Spirit, we shall reap life and joy and fulfillment. Do we believe that? Then would our neighbors and our family recognize it by our lifestyle? Is it self-evident in our living? Does my mother, my father, do my sisters and my brothers, my husband or my wife, my friends, my workmates, do they look at my life and see that it is straight and godly and righteous and faithful, lived under the safe shadow of the Rock of Ages? Is it clear day by day? But then secondly, stress at work. Now, I understand that psychologists divide us all into two broad groups. Those in the first group are type A people. They are the go-getters, the achievers. If you're a type A person, you tend to become addicted to adrenaline. You always want to be driving in the fast lane, to be first away when the traffic lights turn green. You burn up a great deal of nervous energy. You've got to be on a burn-up, elbowing your way to the front of the queue. When the aeroplane has come to a standstill at the airport, the type A person is first on his feet, pushing his way down the aisle, trying to be first off the plane, even though he's going to have to wait, along with everyone else, for his luggage. And when the luggage doesn't come first on the carousel, your type A man gets inwardly angry and impatient. Those in the other group are called type B persons. They are laid back, very easygoing. They drive in the slow lane, and they often cause the most intense irritation to type A persons by getting in the way at roundabouts and taking so long to get moving. Now, just a casual reading of the second half of Genesis 30 tells us what kind of person Jacob was. He was a type A. He was an achiever, a go-getter, a pusher. And it's type A people who suffer most from stress. The first 7 years' work when Jacob was working towards his marriage had seemed just like a few days because he loved Rachel very deeply. But then those second 7 years that he was tricked into working must have been very frustrated. He'd been deceived, you remember, and had married Leah instead of Rachel, all unknown to himself. Laban had pulled a fast one on him, cornering him. But he'd worked really hard. His temperament as an achiever came into full play, and God's hand was upon him. And Laban was so baffled by the dramatic, meteoric increase in his personal wealth, and so puzzled by the way that the farm was taking off in a way it had never done all his life, that he went to some fortune teller to find out if he'd been born under a lucky star or something. But the soothsayer told him, the reason you're doing well is your son-in-law. The God of heaven is with him and is blessing his work. No surprise then when Jacob comes cap in hand at the end of those 14 years of hard slog and announces he wants to go home, back to his parents, back to Canaan, and take Leah and Rachel and his sons with him. No surprise that Laban doesn't want to let him go. Laban appears to be absolutely frank with his son-in-law. He tells him he knows the business is booming because God is blessing Jacob's hard work and prospering his fine management of the farm, and so he offers to pay him. Until now, Jacob's only had his keep. He's been working all these long 14 years for no wages except two wives, when he'd only wanted one. And so Jacob agrees to stay on for a while under simple conditions. Let him, Jacob, take out of the flocks any and every animal that's speckled or black, and that will be his. The animals, the sheep and the goats, which are all of one color, they will be Laban's. Laban agrees, but then the wretched man, did you notice it? He gets to the flocks while Jacob's having his dinner and quickly extracts every single dark and colored and speckled animal and sends some of his sons off with them at least three journeys away. And when Jacob comes back that day to the flocks to remove the animals, which it has been agreed would form the basis of his own stock, there isn't a single one left for him. He's been cheated again. But being your type A person, he sets to, and he works hard, suppressing his anger. And while it's quite impossible to comment on whether or not his amazing gimmicks of trying to breed speckled and dark animals had any effect, God continued to bless him. And beginning with nothing, he rapidly builds up great wealth. And we learn in chapter 31 that Laban altered the agreement he'd made over wages with Jacob no less than 10 times to try and stop his prosperity. But whichever way Laban tried to stop the growth of Jacob's wealth, God's hand was on the man, and he grew richer and richer and richer. Until after 6 years, there were ominous rumblings in Laban's family against Jacob, caused by jealousy of his prosperity. Now just consider for a moment the pressures on this man. Think first of his complete lack of any security in those first 14 years. For a man with drive to be Laban's flunky, Laban's odd job man, must have been very frustrating. We all need some security. But Jacob had had nothing once he embarked on that second term of 7 years in forced labor. But not only was he without security, he was without any goals. And being the kind of man he was, he needed goals, he needed objectives, and yet he had none. He had no home of his own, no money of his own, no check account, no possessions, no prospects for himself or his growing family. And all of that adds up to create stress in the man's system. And on top of that, his home life was an unhappy one. It's a safe guess that with Rachel and Leah snapping at each other, the children were doing the same, squabbling and fighting and arguing. For where parents are at each other's throats all the time, the children imitate and fight among themselves too. And so we see then his stress at home and at work. Now finally this evening, lessons. What does all this mean for us today? Someone says this is a most negative and unhappy story this evening. And so far that's true. We've seen that Jacob has been learning some hard, hard lessons. He's been obliged to drink the cup of bitterness to the very last drop. He's learned that dishonesty and deception bring pain and sorrow. He's learned that when a man cheats, someone suffers. And this time it's himself that is suffering, and how greatly. Nor are the long-term consequences of that going to be wiped out overnight. Indeed, they cannot be. Do you think that Mr. F.W. Clark will suddenly wipe out the hostility and the anger and the hatred of the black majority in South Africa? It will live on for at least 100 years, if not 200 years, if not 300, if we're still here then. Have the people of Northern Ireland not learned that? I was at a wedding a little time ago, and the man sitting beside me at the reception began attacking the Christian faith and the Bible on the ground of the absurdity of saying that God would visit the iniquities of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation. And my answer to that is that anyone with eyes to see and hearts to understand only has to open his newspaper or listen to his news, and he sees that terrible principle of justice being worked right out there before him. So, yes, we have to admit that the chapter is brimming full of negative lessons, of warnings that sin has bitter fruits, and that not one of us has the power or the immunity to escape those fruits. I'm reminded of David, whose heart in the latter years of his reign was lifted up in pride, and God sent an angel with a drawn sword to stretch out his hand to bring David down from his arrogance. And there on Mount Moriah, where Abraham had gone to offer Isaac, David cast himself upon the Lord and on his mercy, knowing that he could not escape the chastisement of God and upon him and his people. In the years to come, when Jacob learned that his son's violence had made his name stink throughout the whole land, he was still drinking the bitter dregs of that awful cup which he had mixed and he had prepared for himself by his sin. My friends, we do not have enough fear of God, nor do we have enough fear of the devil. But the chapter isn't all doom and gloom. There are some rays of sunshine glimmering through the clouds. There is a rainbow in this chapter in the heavens. And because the sky has been so dark, the rainbow shines and glistens even more brightly. And I close this evening with three shafts of pure, clear light, which bring warm comfort to my heart. And the first is this, that Jacob has learned righteousness. The word honesty in verse 33 ought to be translated righteousness. In the Hebrew, it's the word righteousness. And we'll see the record of that meticulous honesty and righteousness another time when we look at chapter 31. But what becomes clearer and clearer is that Laban learns he can trust his son-in-law's word. Jacob has become true as steel. And that undoubtedly is a factor in the phenomenal success of all his work. He really has been converted. There's such clear evidence of God's grace beginning to appear in his life. Slowly, but it's coming. The same grace will not be evident in his 10 sons for many years, but it's there in their father, though he still has far to go, and Laban knows it. He was not so blind as not to see it. He knew Jacob was easy prey for his trickery, just because he was an upright man and would honor his word to the last letter. You see, in some ways, Jacob might be called a sucker. He could easily have argued with Laban about those second 7 years. He could have refused. He could have said, but I had agreed with you to marry Rachel, and here you've married me to Leah. I'm not going to work another 7 years. You can just stuff it. Or he could have taken Laban to court or sued him or something. He most certainly could have gone to an industrial tribunal over the dirty trick Laban played regarding his wages. He had real cause for grievance. But he was strangely above wrangling. He was strangely above arguing. He took the twistedness, the frowardness, to quote Peter speaking about a crooked employer. He took the twistedness of Laban meekly and patiently, far more meekly and patiently than most of us would have done. Not forever, mind you. The time came when he saw enough was enough, and there was a final showdown, and Laban was faced up with his appalling bullying of Jacob. But just now see how upright and how straight and how righteous the man is, and conclude this, that God's grace was not in vain in his life. The fruits of God's work in him are beginning to appear. He's learned that God demands righteous living. But there's a second ray of the sun shining from behind the dark clouds of this chapter, and it's God's care for him. He reminds us of Psalm 1, doesn't he, that whatsoever he does prospers. What a gracious blessing upon him. Laban might have tricked him into working for nothing for 7 extra years, and he might have accepted that meekly and almost, as I said, like a sucker, but God is his defender. And God is his protector, and God more than made up that to him. And so his bank balance grew, and his family were able to afford the occasional meal out in one of the better hotels in Haran. And the boys got new bikes for their birthdays, and Rachel and Leah could afford to buy new clothes instead of having to make do with hand-me-downs. There isn't any sign of Jacob relaxing. True type A, he works as hard as ever. But God doesn't withdraw his hand, but blesses him, and his business grows until he's known far and wide as the most successful farmer in the county. But Jacob knew that it was God's hand of blessing, and his tithes were paid, and he gave bountifully to the needy, as he had pledged and covenanted with God. And the third clear, bright ray of sunlight which broke through at last was the birth of Rachel's first baby boy, and he was called Joseph. And the significant thing about Joseph was that he was reared in his formative years after Peniel. He must have been about 6 when Jacob wrestled with the angel all night and prevailed, and I have no doubt that the home in which he was brought up into his teens was a home with a new piety and a new godliness and a new holiness, so that we shouldn't be surprised that he was such a totally different man to his older brothers who'd been reared in an environment of bitterness and quarreling. And so the birth of Joseph coincides with a turning point, a deeper work that was to come in Jacob's life, and that was going to be reflected in the entire household. I suppose we have to acknowledge that Jacob's love for Rachel and his desire to marry her and not Leah was a correct judgment. For the son that Rachel bore, Jacob, turned out to be one of the most brilliant and talented men the world has ever known. And so this 20-year period of Jacob's life, 14 years of which he's virtually been the slave of his uncle, and 6 years of which at last he comes into his own, it ends with the domestic peace restored as Rachel nurses in her bosom her very own darling son, and God prepares Jacob to return back to the land which was covenanted to be his and his descendants. It is a stressful life. There are great pressures. The speed of life, its competitiveness are very wearing. And our young people today, I think, have an even greater struggle than we had in some ways to get ahead, with examinations and the hunt for work and the struggle to get on, not to mention the trickery and the dishonesty that is abounding all around, and the lack of any morality. How to stay clean, how to act honestly and righteously in a world where so many are dishonest and so unrighteous and seem to get away with it. Stress. Yes, we do need some. We can't avoid some stress. But what we need and what we must have is the God factor in our living. A loving, all-knowing Father who's so wise and so gracious and who plans the best for us, even though he must put us through the fire to refine us. He'll strengthen us to cope with the stress. And he'll work out the pattern and the course of our living. And as for me in this hectic, tempestuous world, how I would tremble not to be in the hand of God. How terrible. What could be worse than to be on one's own? This past week I sat and talked with a man about to make the most terrible decision. And I had, in as loving and as kind but as faithful a way as possible, to warn him of the inevitable consequences of the decision he was on the very brink of making. I say again, as for me, how terrible, what could be worse than to be on one's own in this world? But there's no need to be, none at all. The God of Bethel, who came and guarded and guided and blessed Jacob, he offers himself to be our God and our guide and our Father. And we come to him through his dear Son, who has become the ladder from heaven to earth, who meets us and embraces us and holds our hand and offers to go with us all our days, right to the very end of life's journey. Our hymn is 525. Lead us, Heavenly Father, lead us through this world's tempestuous sea. Guard us, guide us, keep us, feed us, now and to eternity. 525.